So
kick right back.
Yeah, so he met him on meetup.com. This is Alex. So is this technical co-founder? His name is Alex Denner, is that?
Yeah, so his name is Denner Alex.
Denner Alex.
Yeah, instead of using Denner on meetup.com, he used Alex.
Mm. Okay.
And so when I was looking up Alex's, his thing popped up, and him plus I don't know how many other Alex, I just messaged all of them because I didn't know which one I had met. And he's like, hey, I've never been to Montreal, but sure, let's have a coffee. Like, let's go.
And and this business you built, this ended up becoming Nishi. Thanks for correcting me. Yes.
Yeah.
So this is 2012
to 2017.
2017. Yeah. So walk us through some highlights of building Nishi over the past, from 2012 to 2017. What are some major things that stand out for you?
Ooh, I'm just going to go with whatever comes to my mind first is don't build in your backyard.
Don't build in your backyard.
Yeah, don't rely on where you live to build your company.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest mistakes I made with Nishi was not spending more time in the U.S., building partnerships and pitching. I don't know if the outcome would have been more positive, but raising and pitching in Canada was, and like only focusing on Canada was one of the biggest mistakes that I made. Mm. I was like Canada proud, right? And thinking, hey, and we had a revenue, we had a phenomenal technology, the software was just like ridiculous. By then we had 12 designers and developers. Like it was a full on situation and we couldn't get funded here. So one of the biggest highs and lows was getting to that point where we were a company producing revenue, doing all the right things. And one of the biggest lows was not being able to get funded and learning later on that I should have spent more of my time pitching in the U.S.
So pitching in the U.S. So 2017, what was the reason for the demise of Nishi? Like what, I don't know if it's still, you're still involved, but what's so significant about 2017 that
we ran out of money?
Yeah.
But badly ran out of money. And I know, you know, now it's almost like, we can talk, this can be a whole podcast, is about your lifeline number. Everybody should know on a monthly basis what you need to survive, right? What your rent or mortgage or whatever it is, shelter, food, transportation, and keep it basic, but those things should be in place every single month. And you should have enough money, and you should know that number right off the top of your head. You shouldn't even have to think about it, because that it's like that runway, that ability to just cover those costs means you have that much more time to keep iterating and making mistakes until you build an asset of value. And so for me, I broke my own rule because I got so tied and so emotionally tied to this company because we were doing well that I thought, no, I'm going to put every dime I have and every credit card and every, like, everything. I used anything, anything I could sell, I sold to just buy us another day.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it didn't happen and we didn't get funding, to say that we were in the red is an understatement. Like, no money for rent, no money for, right? And then the crushing emotional, like, just fucked. That was the lowest low, but it was because at that point, mainly because we ran out of capital.
Mm-hmm.
We ran out of money from all areas.
What are the reasons that made you run out of capital? Were you not getting customers? Was business slowing down? Like, walk us through that whole period of down the slope towards the end game.
Well, just to run the technology, so we were using AWS, Amazon Web Services, right? You can get free AWS for some period of time, and you can use a free tier for some period of time. But we had a good amount of transactions, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But once you clip that, you need to start paying for that. So you start building up costs with AWS. We were using Ascena. I can't remember now.
Okay.
And Denner would have been more, he would send me like a monthly breakdown of all our costs. But what was it at the time? So at some point, whether it's Google Earth, like there is a package, but it depends on your activity. Depends on the transactions that are happening on your platform. So it's not a set cost. It can go up and down, depending on user interaction. But you start building up those costs. So as your technology becomes more robust and more users are using it, your costs will naturally go up. And so we had revenue, but $15,000 a month is not nearly enough to keep where we were, it wasn't enough to keep us alive. Never mind try to scale. Mm-hmm. Because to try to scale, you now have to improve the security of the platform. You need more marketing dollars. You got to pay yourself. Like, we're like 13 people at that point. Nobody's really getting paid. Most people are sweat equity. But your costs go up, like any company, your revenue. But our revenue was not higher than our costs, especially when you're building something like that robust. Denner and team did a phenomenal job building that out and maintaining that with sweat, with human capital. But you need money. Like, you need money. At some point, you're going to need money. $15,000 a month is peanuts.
How are you acquiring your customers?
Oh, there were so many methods. Our primary was, once we had a couple of hundred people that were engaged, really, really engaged with the platform was built in such a way where you were incentivized to bring more people on. You were incentivized to invite brands to come into the marketplace. So it was very community driven, like almost entirely community driven. We weren't really, I don't think we were spending any marketing dollars at all. Well, we didn't have it. Right. But the very platform was a decentralized marketplace where if you guys joined, best way I can describe it. If you invited more folks to join, we would give you what's called niche dollars. OK, if you invited a brand to come onto the platform, you would get niche dollars for that. If that brand, because you invited them, so you were the source of origination, any sales that brand did, any further interaction that brand benefited from, you would get a portion of that because you originally brought that piece together. Mm-hmm. No matter where you shared information about that brand, or if somebody else came onto the site and shared information about that brand, we built software into those interactions where for like the next, I'm sure if we checked now, maybe it would still capture. You can share it on Facebook, like wherever. And the software would just follow where the interactions took place throughout the web. And if somebody, unlike affiliate marketing, you couldn't see where the points of interaction were. The technology would just follow it wherever it went. So if he buys something from that brand 3 years down the road, your wallet will receive a piece of that. It's small. It's not about making you wealthy overnight. It's about making sure that the community continues to thrive whenever anybody or any brand in the community thrives. And that was our basis for building
net niche. New users.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was that the main focus of the brand, or like what was the exact value add for each customer?
It depended. So there were three users. There's you, a user who's there to just almost like an ambassador.
Okay.
You can be a buyer or you can be the brand. Mm-hmm. As an ambassador, you can invite brands, you can invite other people, and you get tokens. Okay. Nishi, we call them Nishi coins. If you're a buyer, by buying there, we ask the brands to provide a discount to anybody who bought on the platform. So you might, just by buying on the platform, you might get like 10% off.
Gotcha.
And then the brands, we made sure that they would get the largest margin versus where they were paying, let's say, on some other marketplaces. Because on other marketplaces, they take a larger amount. We're like, we don't need to take a larger amount. We calculated, I think we needed about 4% to 5% of net sales to be able to grow the way we wanted to grow. Mm-hmm. But everybody's interaction would capture them a little piece of that sale. And we figured if we can keep that going, we can build a self-sustaining marketplace where everybody involved in the marketplace gets a piece of the pie, including the brand. And there were a lot of brands who couldn't get like on big box retail stores, because you need to have like if you want to get into Walmart, for example, you need to have millions. And Amazon wasn't then what it is now. Now it's like Amazon takeover, right? But it wasn't as powerful as it was then. And so we started to build this nice group of, became eventually 130,000 people, but over 7,000 of them were very, very engaged, sharing, inviting new brands on. And it was like, okay, cool, this is starting, right? And then we got to a point where we had about 15,000 in revenue from these little peppered interactions, but not enough to scale, like not nearly enough. You need millions of dollars to scale something like this.
Yeah.
Like any like scalable technology, you need millions of dollars.
So you shut down the business.
Yeah.
What's next after 2017? What do you have your eyes set on?
Just wiping up my tears. Seriously, it's like, yeah. those were rough days.
How was it, before you move on from that, mm-hmm. how was your mental state during that time?
Horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible. Like, you don't even know how bad you are. That was me. I didn't know how bad I was. Because the adrenaline and just the crazy focus of keeping it alive, even when it was dead, I was just like, I'd wake up and I'm like, no, it's not dead yet. It's so shocking to the system. And then it's like, fuck, I don't have money for rent. Fuck, I don't have money for this. Like, so there was no immediate like, oh, okay, let's just pivot. It's mm-hmm. like, no, I gotta like feed myself first. Like, how do I eat tomorrow? So you start to like panic. There's a panic. I got sick. Anyway, not for long. But I had a phenomenal team. And so I said, and it was all guys, one girl. I was like, guys, we have built, and I give this to them, one of the best, like the technology, the software was insane. This machine was insane what it could do for a fully bootstrapped company. And I was like, I think I'm just going to go out and get us some contracts. Why don't we build software for other companies until we just pay our bills? What do you guys think? They're like, cool. A lot of them went and got jobs because they had to, right? A lot of them had jobs and were working on Nishi part-time. But we, they're like, yeah, go out and get some. And so that's hustle. The hustle pivoted. I was like, I'm going to go find clients that need software built. And the group of engineers that we had on the team, like Denner, for example, he's built like systems for banks. Like he's not like a little engineer. Like these guys have built some crazy shit. So I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go find companies that need software built. Let's bring in some contracts. Let's pay our bills. Let's eat. Let's like take a pause. Put some money in the bank and let's see if we want to revisit this. Mm-hmm. Instead of relying on outside capital, let's see if we can create our own revenue through another stream, bring the revenue back into the product and start again. That was the plan. But 2-3 years later, that's how long it took us to get out of the hole and put some good money in the bank. By that point, timing is a hell of a thing. So Nishi didn't have the impact. We lost touch with the community. Like, you can't just ignore your community for like 2 years and expect to come back and just start up the whole thing mm-hmm. again. So we're like, no, let's just build software for companies. We're doing well. And that's why I'm, you know, in the position that I am today to be able to sit here and be like, all right, what I want to build a fund.
You yeah. are, business is healthy.
Build this, yeah.
You
yeah.
know, it's allowing you to be a VC now. Yeah. So let's get into that, right? You know, we really want to tap into that.
Before you move on, one thing I also compliment you on is the fact that mm-hmm. you know they stayed with you. That's a really big.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a really big move. The fact
people
that
people is everything.
Yeah,
people is everything.
They must have really believed in you, you know, because as software developers, we were just saying like
they're in high demand.
Commodities.
Yeah,
they're sexy out here.
You know what? I think it's just in life. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think a business relationship is different than a romantic relationship or any different than a family relationship. Like, just. Like, be upfront with people. At no point did I say, hey guys, this is gonna, it's perfect. No, I'd be like, guys, we're in fucking fire right now. What do you guys want to do? And you, like, the solution didn't always come from me, right? Many times the solution came from them. And I asked them, how do we get out of this? And so you end up becoming this crazy fucking family after this mission. And so you're not no longer dealing with like software developers. You're dealing with people who want to achieve something for whatever reason as much as you do. And they're willing to lay that shit out on the line. And so, it's like any crazy family. Like, okay, we had a baby, we had a problem. Do we just break up, or do we figure out our next move? Because we know each other so well. And I've seen again with the work that I did in the capital markets, most businesses fail is not because of money or technology or whatever. It's because the partners just they don't see eye to eye. Most business fail because partners don't see eye to eye. And you don't usually know that.
Mm-hmm.
The partners know. Deep inside, the partners know whether shit is gelling.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't see that from the outside. But deep in, like, I don't know, you guys have been working together for a while. When you have great partners, when you have great partners, it's not about the project.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if this shit doesn't work out, you can do something else. When the partnership is tight, like a marriage, like, if I find somebody I'm in love with and things are great, why am I going to go and like, no, I'm not saying you want open marriages. That's cool. That's Jada and Will. Like, I'm cool. Like, do what you got to do, right?
An entanglement.
Listen, it all works. I'm just saying me, I'm monogamous, right? Yeah. Like I'm serial monogamous. So if I connect with folks, like gang, we're like for life. Mm-hmm. And I found a group of people that just had a passion, regardless of the project. They're just like, we got to build something. We got to do something. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm the luckiest motherfucker.
You're blessed. And highly favored.
Blessed.
Now let's move on.
Let's get into VC. So now you are, business, as I said, is healthy. Nishi Studios is, you know, it's running on its own. Now you want to explore your further ambitions of building a VC fund. What's the first inclination you had that I want to do this?
Well, I wanted to do this. Remember, I wanted to do this before when I was doing work with the wealth management company. And there weren't very many VCs here that he could introduce me to. But I knew. I just knew the power of technology before I even got this far deep into it. And I started to see how money moves. And I'm just like, I want to do VC. Mm-hmm. I didn't know exactly why. So when I didn't get funded for Nishi, I was just like, as soon as I do well in life. And for me, it's like not even an option. As soon as I do well in life, I'm going to invest in people that look like me. Because we didn't talk about a lot of the reasons why we didn't also get in capital. And I don't like spending time on things that didn't work out. Spilt milk. But that experience, by 2017, I was like, mark my word, at some point I will do well and I will build a fund and I'm going to invest in a bunch of other underestimated and unstoppable founders that look like us in the room. And so said, so done. I didn't think it was going to happen now, but here we are. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So it's been how long since you hatched Matter? Like, how long has it been?
I mean, I still haven't launched it, right?
Yeah,
just deciding. 4 days after George Floyd is when it started, when I just decided, when I made the decision. It was actually not supposed to happen for another 2 years. But I was just like, after George Floyd, all kinds of reasons why. I was just like, I can't walk the earth angry like this. Mm-hmm. Got to do something. It was straight goods. And in Brazil, like, more than 100 black men die every single month. Never mind. And I'm not disrespecting what happened with George Floyd. But when that shit happened, I was like, there was an anger. Parkdale came out, baby. Yeah. Parkdale came out. And I was just like, Giselle, it's not good. You've been taught. It's not good to walk the earth with that kind of energy. You're here to, like, alchemy is the name of the game. What are you going to do about it? You don't like it? What are you going to do about it? And I was like, okay. You're not like super loaded, but do you think you have enough? Can you pull off launching a fund? And I was like, let's do it. So that was Dave, 4 days after. And so it's been in the making now.
Yeah. See, a lot of people don't know the VC world. Mm-hmm. You know, we're still learning every single day. So what goes into a VC fund? Because when we think about a VC fund, we think it's just a bunch of wealthy guys who got together and they're like, hey, let's chip our money in and go in. But there's also outsiders as well who've never been a VC before, but they have the ability to pull people together to create a fund, like, let's say, like a Sequoia, right? Mm-hmm. Like an Andreessen Horowitz. Mm-hmm. So walk us through that step of, like, how you attain the money, what's the decision criteria, and, like, what are some returns that you get when you're investing in these startups from, like, a VC, say, like, the industry? Like, what's, like, the average VC firm get?
So I hear three questions. What's the process?
Yep.
Like, how does it happen?
Mm-hmm.
Second question was,
like, the overall industry, like, yeah.
Just generally the industry and then returns.
Exactly.
So most funds, and there's different structures, but most funds are what's called a 2 in 20. Yes, it's made up of two groups. You have your general partners, who are the founders of the fund, and you have your limited partners, who are the people you go out to ask them to invest in the fund. As a general partner, which I am, and there's another gentleman that I invited to join, you have to be the first one to put money into the fund. Okay? So we both had to put money into the fund. That's number one. Then you decide, what's your thesis? What is the fund going to focus on, right? And there's a number of funds now dealing with underrepresented or underestimated founders, where, unlike a Sequoia, Horowitz, they didn't necessarily have ridiculous amounts of money where they could just, right? write their own checks and start the fund. Kind of like me, did okay, put some capital in, and it could take you a few years to find other what's called accredited investors. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the term accredited investors. That can then invest in the fund. Then that entire pie is then invested into other companies. The formation of it is you hire some lawyers, tell them like generally what your thesis is, what your structure is, how big you want the fund to be. Active investors. And that's where we are now, where you have like the terms of the fund, the breakdown, the details of the fund, the goals of the fund, what areas you're focused on. Is it North America, Canada, US, outside of, right? And as somebody launching a fund, you can decide, you can do whatever you want with your fund. You just got to keep in mind that there's going to be investors who are open to certain levels of risk. They're going to be open to investing in a certain type of founder. They typically invest in the things that they know. A lot of them like to invest in regions where they reside. So the more complex your fund, I'm not going to say it's always harder, but trickier it's going to be to find outside people who don't know you to align with what it is you've decided is going to be the focus of your fund. But that whole process, like for us, it's been about a year of deciding what the fund is, deciding the size of the fund, deciding which lawyers we're going to work with, what regions we're going to focus on. And so the more regions, the more complex. So we're registered in Canada and the U.S., so we had to hire lawyers in Canada. We had to hire lawyers in the U.S. to be able to register the fund in both jurisdictions, right? And there's, again, this is what I'm saying in that first year is like deciding, like, really, what do you want this fund to be able to do? And for me, it's like learning that Canada is phenomenal for talent, phenomenal for execution, but we don't have a market here. Right, the size of our market, not say we don't have a market, companies have done very well in Canada, but the size of the market in the US as an example, because there's Africa, there's South America, these are all markets. To be able to invest in a Canadian company, for example, and start building out networks in the US and giving them access to the US is much more valuable to a company than to just focus on Canada, as an example. So do we spend an extra $500,000 and like register there and do all the things there? It's like, If my focus is that founders will fucking win, then that's what I have to do. And that's why we structured the fund the way that we did. Doesn't mean you have to. So Horwitz, for example, I don't know on how many countries they are. I know they started off in the US. I don't know if they've expanded or not. Sequoia's done quite a bit of expansion. And so in every region you decide you want to register that fund, you have to deal with the regulators in that country. Everybody has like, right, different regulatory framework. For us, it was Canada and US, which is why it took a little longer to figure out, how do we do this? How much money are we gonna need? Which lawyers do we want? But it also allowed us to work with investors in the US. So investors in the US can invest in our Canadian fund, but there's a small tax incentive if we structure it there. It's more beneficial from a tax perspective to try and find investors there with a US registered fund there. And that was another reason why we're like, we have to be very easy to do business with. If we want to be easy to do business with, and I'm going to go to you and I'm going to say, hey, cut us a check for $250,000 or $1 million, you're going to be like, okay, how is this going to affect me once we start getting returns? How's it going to impact my tax? Whether it's a little and it's a small impact, but wealthy people, one of the first things they want to do is like, oh, if you want me to invest, you can like make it beneficial to me, not the other way around. And that's why we registered there. So just a lot of thought behind why is that I want founders, even if we invest here, to have access to the U.S. market.
So those are two separate businesses?
Yeah, technically they are. They're the same fund.
Same fund, but two different
businesses. They're tied together. Our lawyers talk, and they make it seamless. So you wouldn't know the difference as a founder. You wouldn't know the difference as an investor. But they are actual two registered funds. One's Canada, one's U.S.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, you bring up a very interesting concept because we talk about this all the time.
Yeah.
You know, Canada versus America, where to go as a Canadian entrepreneur. You know, and we've seen companies, Instacart, for example, that start here, start in Waterloo, blow up, move to San Fran. You know, what's your opinion on building a company in Canada versus the U.S.? Because the population of Canada can fit in California. You know, it's the reality of life right now. Versus Texas has, and California is literally like two Canadas, right? But there's still a lot of opportunity in Canada, right? There's the DMZ, you know, there's different funds going on in Canada. Mars, you know? So where do you stand with that?
My thing is this. I've always believed the world is a global playground. My personal view, not anybody else's. If you're thinking locally, you're thinking too small. And I say this even pre-COVID, but if we haven't seen it through COVID, where some of the largest companies, the most darling of companies of the world, have lost their shirts, and the scrappiest people and the scrappiest founders are making it work and starting to build game-changing companies. And, you know, I know we were connected through Pollyanna, but I can't tell you the number of people I connected with over COVID, because people are not as tied to borders as they used to be.
Shut up, Pollyanna.
They're not as tied to borders. And it's like, you guys have a phenomenal platform. You have merch. You have a message. It's like me asking you, do you want to keep your message in Canada? You guys went to Afrotech in the U.S. It's just like, why? My question is like, why not? Why would you limit yourself? And so expand as much as you can mm-hmm. with the resources you have. And jumping over to the U.S. where we all speak English, generally the culture is the same. But the market is like, and I'm not talking about just population. I'm talking about buying power, commercialization power, risk tolerance. Mm-hmm. The U.S.'s risk tolerance is through the roof.
So
through the roof. So I'm like, if you're going to build something in Canada, I think you're doing yourself a disservice, truly, by not looking at the U.S. and at least planning to expand there. I'm not saying you have to do it now, but to just plan to expand in the U.S., if you're not thinking that way, I think you're thinking way too small.
For sure. So we had this conversation actually, and I'd love to hear your opinion. It's because when it comes to, you know, business podcast, you know, there is a small sect in Canada, you know, so it gives us a small pond to become a big fish in.
Yeah.
You know, whereas there is a bit of a ceiling of where you can go, but the thing is, like, we're nowhere close to the ceiling that is here in Canada.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd love to get your opinion, because the thing is too is that business in Canada is different than business in the States.
Very.
Business in Quebec is drastically different than business in Ontario.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's a gap in the market right now for entrepreneurship, knowledge, or I hate saying the word knowledge now. Thanks.
Knowledge. Thanks, shout out to Ty Lopez.
Yeah. I hate that guy. I want to know why you hate him. Okay, I want to know why you hate him. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I could quickly go into that.
Yeah, I want to know.
But
because I'm talking too much. I want to hear some.
Yeah.
But, you know, so we look at both lenses, because there is an opportunity to provide people here. But like I said, everyone goes to the States because of the opportunity for the population, right? So I'd love to get your opinion on that, because there's an open market here, you know. So, yeah, what are your thoughts? And then I'll tell you about Ty Lopez and why I hate him.
Listen, I think we just have to do the things that we want to do, right? The reasons I step into the U.S., and or Brazil will be stepping into parts of Africa, it's because that's just the way I move. That's what I want to build. But that might not be what you want to build, right? So I think it's less about my, like, and I mean a little bit of disrespect when I say this, it's like, I've always known since I was a kid, I'm here to play a global game. Because I'm like, why the fuck not? Why not? Mm-hmm. Especially as black people, we're everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we have no reason to play in this pond. Now, it's one thing if you want to establish yourself, establish your brand. You guys have a phenomenal brand here, bar none. And dominate. If you're like, I want to dominate the Canadian marketplace, cool. And if that is your goal and your end game, then do it and do it well, right? Doesn't matter what I think. What is your vision for your company? Where do you want to take it? How valuable do you think your message is? Because I think, I know some people in Brazil would love to hear your podcast. Can it be translated into Portuguese? It can, but is that your desire, or is that my view? So it's like, whatever your desire is, I'm just saying don't put a cap on it. And that's it. I'm always like, I'm just more of that girl, like, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Why not us?
Mm-hmm.
Versus geography, right? I'm just not tied to geography, because I think there's brilliant people all around the world that want what the fuck I have to sell. Again, randos.
Yeah.
It's like randos. Like, there's just random people who want to meet me. There's random people that want to meet you. And I mean, we're all like 1-2 degrees away from the rest of the world, especially Canada. I think Canada is a very, very special place, because we did all come in, like, right? I'm sure we all have friends from different parts of the world. I can find out what's happening in Iran, in Brazil, in Germany, some way by just making that one phone call. So if I have 1 to 2 degree separation from the rest of the world, why not? Mm-hmm. For me, it's more of a why not. So I don't know if that answers your question. It's like, I don't think there's a right or wrong. It's like, for example, my fund, some people will not stop until they're a Sequoia. I don't need to be Sequoia. I need to be a medium-sized firm that's a global player. I'm very clear that this is going to be a global fund by fund number 3. Mm-hmm. Sequoia wants to maybe dominate the U.S. Maybe that's their playing ground for whatever reason. So I think it's just defining what you want to be and just deciding that that's, yeah. But just don't put limits on it. Don't put limits on it.
No, no. Yeah, we definitely don't want to put limits on it.
I know you guys have no limit. But no, I'm just like.
We're thinking big.
We're thinking big, yeah.
The best. That's where you want to be.
Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, why not?
Exactly.
Like, why? Listen, I'm not saying, like, I don't know, is this another conversation, Jay-Z versus Nas? But, like, Jay did say, is like, you come to play this to come in second?
Mm-hmm.
Like, who shows up at a sports game to come in second? You come in second, you gave it your all, you come in second, cool. But you actually show up to be like, nah, I'm showing up so I can lose. I can be second or third. No, I'm here to fucking win. And it's like okay to say that. Mm-hmm. To your point, it's like, mm-hmm. right? And it's not me winning. This is something way bigger than me.
Well, that's not really first and seconds, though. Like, I feel to decide to stay in the market isn't really a first or second thing. Like, for instance, no. You know, Harry Rosen staying in Canada isn't really making it a second Bay tier company. It's still like a $1 billion company.
No,
you know what I'm saying?
They're killing it.
The Bay, same thing, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, because the thing is that you feel like I'm limiting myself by staying in this geography. We could also become the biggest player in that space as well. So it's neither a first or second. It's more like this the way you want to win, you know?
And I'm saying for myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm saying. It's not, I've decided I want to play globally, mm-hmm. right? And that is what I consider first place for me.
Interesting.
It's not me comparing myself to a Sequoia. That's not what I'm doing, mm-hmm. right? I'm saying, what vision have I manifested for myself? And I'm there to meet, like, that's the goal for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's my sport, right? I'm actually not competing. But my thing is, if I'm out to play a global game, me coming in second means that I'm going to stay in North America. That's what I mean. Right. So if your number one goal is to dominate Canada, then dominate Canada. And that's your first place.
Yeah.
But if you don't dominate Canada.
Now you're in second.
Now you're in second. Facts. But you're not competing against anybody. You're competing against yourself. So sorry, that's what I meant.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have competitors outside of myself.
Yeah.
But I have my vision and I'm going to execute on it by any means necessary.
Gotcha. So no one will hear why I hate Ty Lopez.
Yeah, I want to
hear
know
my
why
garage. Have you seen those Hear My Garage commercials?
No.
No,
see, tell me.
Legendary commercials.
I want to learn about you guys. Like, I know we're talking here. I just hear myself talk.
So
no,
I have a social media marketing agency. You know, mm-hmm. it's called Whip Media.
Yeah.
We do paid marketing, and I've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
Straight out of college. And, yeah, I've been doing it for years. You know, I really believe in it. And I've just been building the business up. And come Ty Lopez into the situation. Okay. And Ty Lopez's thing is building one-and-done social media companies. That's his thing. So what he teaches people to do is to quickly go out and just get clients that will, you'll pay $10,000 a month and they'll do Facebook ads for them or something like that of the sort.
Yeah.
And that's in my lane. So what happens is, it starts becoming a cyclical cycle with other social media marketers. What happens is this. They'll go to you and say, hey, you want some ads? I'll do some ads for you. And they don't focus on the actual execution of it. So mm-hmm. they'll go to you, get that contract, maybe do 3-4 months, you churn onto the next person. They churn mm-hmm. onto the next person. And they build up this like three-month churn business
mm-hmm.
of, you know, trash services,
mm-hmm.
but they're getting $30,000 a month. So $30,000 every 3 months, you know, yeah. per client. So they can build a quick business in no time because they're speaking to randos through marketing, yeah. right? So that leaves a bad taste in a ton of people's mouths.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I kind of dislike it.
That's why you're not
a fan. Yeah.
Yeah, it's transactional based.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
So
it's not relationship building. It's not, yeah, it's not a long-term, I got your back business. It's
like
pump and dump.
Exactly. So now, if I happen to get anything wrong, I'm in them now. You know?
Yeah.
So that's why I'm like, oh, this guy, he's ruined the market for a lot of people. Because a lot of people, you know, they really believe in doing quality work with the people they care about. So, yeah, that's why I'm like, oh, this guy.
You know what? And not saying a but, and not that you asked for my opinion, but I think in some ways it's the perfect storm for you. Because if there's a lot of people that are unhappy about that and they're seeing that, in the back of their mind, they're just praying that somebody like you is going to show up. And they're going to give you pushback, right? And you might have to work a little harder for it. But any good relationship is worth it. Because once you build that relationship, you're like, again, it's like relationships, right? Whether it's family, whether it's business, they're relationships. We're all human at the end of the day. Business is not business. It's people. It's just people.
Mm-hmm.
And people are like, well, there's personal and business. I don't believe there's a difference.
Really? Nah, I gotta give you pushback on that, yo.
Because
in the business world, you hire somebody to do a specific job. If they're great people, but they don't get that job done, you have to let them go.
Yeah.
That's the reality of it.
It is.
So we can say that they're family, but at the end of the day, like, they gotta do their job. And if they don't, they're fired.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, like, to say that they're family, I can't go all the way with that, because it's like, you don't really fire family. You stuck with family.
Yeah.
You know?
I fire family.
Okay. You can...
I'm not pushing back on you. I'm just saying, I'm of the belief that for me, it's more important to have healthy relationships. Facts. Be they business, personal, romantic, etc. Because I think a lot of us, and I'm going to say, when I say us, black people too, yes, us. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes we hold on to family because it's family. And I think we have a responsibility to family to make sure that, to the best of our ability, they're okay. But that doesn't mean we're going to be hanging out if you're not good for me. I'm going to check on you. I'm going to check in with other family members and see if you're okay. And if I have the means to help and support, I'm your girl. But if it's a toxic relationship and it's not serving me well, it's not helping me grow, what I can't afford is you saying, well, we're family, so stick with it. Absolutely not. There's good relationships. It's all relationships. And I have some friends that have become family. I had clients have become family, but not all clients are family. I'm not saying all clients can be family. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying at the core, good business, good family, good romantic relationships, at the core of them are good people who understand give and take, who want a long-term healthy relationship, not a relationship for a relationship. Reasons. So yeah, I've got some clients who are just like, you and I are not going to be friends.
Yeah.
Right? And they can fire me, or I can let go of them as clients. But I also choose my clients for that reason. I don't want to work with assholes.
Mm-hmm.
I've put in grind and worked with people that they're fucked because I needed to do what I needed to do. I'm not doing that anymore. So I'm just, that's all my personal is like, if you're hurting in your personal life, if your personal life is not healthy, it's going to affect your business life. If your business life is not healthy, it's going to affect your personal life. And that's what I meant by business and personal.
Most definitely.
But yeah, if you're not performing, I mean, there's still a business relationship there. We got to cut that.
Yeah.
And if there's a friendship there, we can maintain our friendship. It's tricky to do that once one goes, right? But no, I don't believe in business just because we entered into a transaction and we're going to keep working together because we're buddies. I don't believe in that either.
Yeah, most definitely. And one thing I want to touch on too is that there's companies too that will leverage family. That like, oh yeah, we're family. And then they're throwing things on you. they're just like you know, like cranking you up, cranking the use of this relationship out over the umbrella of family. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that as well? Like, it's a real thing, you know?
How have you dealt with it?
How have I dealt with it? The one time I was in that relationship where they're like, yeah, we're a family here, it was at a startup, and their startup ended up folding, you know. Facebook implemented what they were doing, so the investors asked for the money back, and the whole team started, like, getting laid off. Okay. So that's how it ended. So and that included me. So that's how that relationship ended. And during that time, it was okay, you know. There was times it was definitely not something I wanted to be a part of, but that's like any business relationship. There's days where you're just like, why am I? So, but.
How is that different than this in terms of the relationship?
Who, Alex and I?
Two of you versus what you just described to me. You know, you're like, some days you didn't want to do certain things. Oh, no, this business is hard, right? Mm. But the people that you were working with, was that respect, connection?
Oh, definitely anything, not. Definitely not.
What was different?
Good question. What was different? I'm going to say, well, first off, the respect level, the camaraderie between the people that I was working with, you know, they definitely were trying to look at me as someone who wasn't capable. And had little sly remarks to try and show that, you know. So that was one. It was more of trying to create a competitive environment versus one of growth. So that was some of the things that kind of pushed me. And yeah, there's also judgment. Like, I'll never forget this one time. I showed up early for work, right? And I went to make cereal in the kitchen. And then the boss came in and messaged the guy, because he saw me in the kitchen making some cereal for myself. And he messaged my manager to say, oh, yo, tell Alex needs to be on time. And then the manager, seeing that I was early, went and told me that just to keep visibility. So then I look at him, I'm like, you know I'm early. So how do you do that? Oh, no, just to keep visibility or just to keep the side of me doing my thing. You know what I'm saying? So things like that, of someone saying their family but not actually having her back was a prime example of that, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah.
And so this works because?
This works because, you know, it's like a 1-2 punch, you know? I'll put it like this. We went to Africa together on a trip on a whim. And when you go on a trip with your friend, one of two things happens. You know what I'm saying? One of two things happens. Either you end up hating that friend.
Facts.
Or you end up loving that friend.
Facts.
We're the latter. You know what I'm saying? So
Even through my snoring, because I have a massive snoring problem. Alex still came back.
Well, yeah.
You're like, I wasn't sure if he was going to come back or not.
I wake up the morning, and I'm looking at Alex, and I see this guy has his, like, I don't know, Beats. He had, like, these massive headphones. And I'm like, man, Alex is so committed to, like, listening to some audiobook or some podcast or whatever.
Yeah.
I look at the clock. It's, like, 8 a.m. I'm like, what's he listening to? Like, we just went to bed at, like, 2-ish because we just stayed up night drinking and talking. So this guy's committed to, like, something, because he's not listening to music. You don't listen just to hip-hop at 8.
Right.
Something is something peaceful, like a podcast. And I'm like, yo, Al, bro, like, what's up, man? Why are you awake? He's like, dog. Like, I'm like, what's up? He's just like, yo, you're snoring so hard. And I'm like, man, I'm sorry, man. Like, you know, it's just like, man, I couldn't even sleep. I tried putting pillows on top. I tried everything.
Oh,
and Alex's face when he's pissed,
like,
I can already tell. Like, sometimes it's like, man, Alex is cheese. Like, I was just kind of like, you know, dilly dallying around the room, like on my toes. I just want to like edge him off because I knew he's already like having a bad morning and he didn't get enough sleep, so he's cranky.
Oh man!
So through that, you know, like still, you know, we're riding strong. We're building. We got a, you know, vision that we gotta accomplish.
Get it.
You know, before, like, anything, you know, like, as long as you stay healthy, like, we're going to complete it. So, yeah, that's why. And we just have a mutual respect for each other.
I love it.
Yeah,
right?
Respect. Yeah.
So if he sees something I need to improve on, he's like, yo, oh, like, I don't like the way you do this on the show. You got to ask this, like that, like that.
Mm-hmm.
Vice versa, you know? So it's just like, we want to see each other win. And for me to to win and for him to win, I need to be at my best for him and vice versa, right? It's that's how great partnerships are.
100, yeah, man. Yeah, 100. And that's all I was saying earlier. It's like, this is personal. Mm-hmm. This is like, I'm not trying to get all deep, but this is not transactional, right? It's not business as usual. He's like, he can look at you and he knows when you're not, like, you're cheesed. That's not business. That's personal, right? So that's all I meant by there's a place for personal and business. I think they're actually pretty intertwined. Mm-hmm. And whatever you guys are building next, like, would you want to be building it with anybody else? Probably not. You might add some folks, whatever, but your guy is there. And now you feel like there's nothing you can't build. Like, that's dope. Like, mm-hmm. that's... And, man, when you find partners like that, you do everything you need to do to keep it in check. Everything. Like a marriage. Like a family member.
Great question. All right. How'd y'all deal with bad situations? How did y'all deal with feedback? How do you deal, like, with your past partner? Well, you guys are still working together, right?
Yeah.
So walk me through, because one thing we do, we communicate all the time.
Over-communicate.
Did you have a specific, wow, I'm tripping over my words today. Did you have a specific way of talking to him about problems?
Mm-hmm.
Talk me through that.
We just talk. We talk, like, do you know how many times people thought he was my husband? Enough times we go places.
Yeah.
And they're like, are you guys? They don't, they would just, that was the gesture.
Yeah.
And we would laugh because we talk as if we are. Like, talk to my crew, like friends, like I said, who have become family. Like, I'm just going to fucking tell you as it is because we don't have time. We're grown.
Yeah.
Right? He has a daughter. He's now divorced, but he's a grown man. Like, if you respect somebody, you're just going to tell them not to be hurtful, right? So I know his personality as well. So I'll prepare him, say, hey, I'm having some concerns. Here are my concerns. He might not like it. Sometimes he comes to me because he's much more black and white than I am. Very nice human being, but much more black and white. I'm a little bit more creative. And my creativity sometimes drives him nuts. Because see how I talk? I talk like, he's an engineer, so he thinks differently. So sometimes when he talks, it cuts, and I'm like, oh, that stung. But I know it's coming from a place of growth, and it's coming from a good place. So the intention behind the comment is good, because that's who he is. He's a guy of good intention. He's not here to hurt me, right? He's like, he wants us to do well in whatever we do. So if he's looking out for me and I'm genuinely looking out for him, I don't care what he tells me. Even though it might sting sometimes. That's just good relationship. Like a marriage. Nobody wants to hear that they fucking snore and whatever. I don't know how you felt. Like, you're just like, fucking this guy. And you're just, and you're just like, oh, I snored. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
right? Like,
man.
But that's who he is. He snores. Right? Yeah. So now you're going to be like, fuck, I gotta put this shit on my head again.
Now I got to wear a mouth guard next time we travel.
See?
So it opens up my mouth so like the air can pass properly.
Hey, I hope you're liking the show. Right now, to support the show, you can hop over to hustleovereverything.co, not .com, and shop some of our merch. We have amazing pieces on sale right now, so go check that out. Also, if you're not already following us, go check us out on Instagram at 247Hustler and at 247Hustlers on Twitter. All right, now let's get back into the show. Peace. We back. We live. Let's go.
Yeah.
So going back to the fund,
mm-hmm.
you know, what does success look like for you in, let's say, once you launch it and you're running it for 2 years? What is that? What success look like from the entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. for you, for mm-hmm. the team?
Mm-hmm.
Walk us through that.
Primary thing is, you know, I'd love that at least half of our companies go on to get further funding and they continue to grow and scale. And I'm equally excited that those who don't do as well can continue to run their business.
Mm-hmm.
And we structured the fund in a certain way where there's a huge network that we're building around the fund specifically for that reason. If you're doing well, you've got like all kinds of crazy powerful people that you can call to help you open doors, do certain things. And for those of you who, for whatever reason, because business is fail, it's just, we can't control the outcome, but we can manage how you can either continue to grow the business, maybe not scale it too, because not everybody needs to be a unicorn. But if you can build a company that's sustainable, that you can grow through revenue over time and keep more of that company, then that's our goal, is you can buy your equity back from us, right? And keep the company going. And we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that, because the VC industry, I find it to be very soulless in many cases. And it's numbers. It is numbers. And I get it. It's business. But I don't believe in business as usual as it currently functions in the VC world, where they're just really looking for typically their top 10% of companies to do what's called pay the fund, mm-hmm. which is return all the capital back and return a lot of the gains back. They're really just relying on the top tier of companies. And those who fail, it's like deuces. And I just don't believe in that model. So I'd be very, very happy to know that the majority of our companies, or even half of them, have gone on to grow and scale and do the things that they wanted to do. But that those that don't still have access to the network to keep going, and maybe not scaling, but continuing to build a business mm-hmm. and build legacy in that business.
Are you familiar with Chamath's Ponzi scheme video that went viral?
Oh, man. I haven't. Okay, I've heard of it, but I haven't watched it.
Okay.
And there's a lot about Chamath that I really love, and there's a lot of shit that's coming out about him that I don't, like, lately. So I don't know what's real or not, but tell me about, because there's a lot that he says that I love, but go for it.
So he talks about a Ponzi scheme that happens in the startup world where this is happening. I think it started with Facebook and the tremendous growth of Facebook, where an entrepreneur comes to an investor, you know, gets VC funding, mm-hmm. and he starts getting traction, and they're like, all right, you're doing this growth? No, we need this growth. Mm-hmm. And he starts saying, all right, cool, let's start doing that. Mm-hmm. And he starts investing his money in the big three, Facebook and Instagram, Google, Amazon. Mm-hmm. And they're getting net new clients. But it's all paid. Mm-hmm. So they're actually building a paid acquisition business and not an actual product market fit business. Mm-hmm. So they're reporting back to the VCs now in those boardroom meetings, saying, look at our growth. We've gotten X growth. And then they're like, oh, look, this is becoming the top 10% company for us. Mm-hmm. We need you to grow more. Or your company's burning, take more money. At the same time, their LTVs ain't hitting. Mm-hmm. Lifetime value, for people who don't know, mm-hmm. lifetime value of a customer. Mm-hmm. So customers are churning quickly. Mm-hmm. The CAC is starting to rise. Mm-hmm. Cost to acquire a customer. Mm-hmm. And they're still continuously, you know, burning money to get those clients in the door so they can say, hey, we had 300% growth.
Yeah.
And now the investor's like, you see this growth? You see what I see in my baby here? Mm-hmm. We're killing it. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to run out of funding. So they're, all right, time for Series B. And this cycle continues and continues and continues till mm-hmm. they go public. The company buys a turd. Mm-hmm. And before they know it, they have a sinking ship, everyone leaves, and it's a Ponzi scheme. Mm-hmm.
Is that what happened with WeWork?
So, here's what I've learned about WeWork, but remember, not being in the inside, and I say this for any business, when you're not on the inside, you're getting secondary, tertiary information, right? It's like chair-side research. You're getting what other people are saying. But yes, what I heard about WeWork is that what's the name of the company that invested ridiculous?
SoftBank.
Yeah, poured ridiculous amounts of money, and that the head of SoftBank, you know, they do business a certain way, and they just poured in a ridiculous amount of money. But that apparently that was understood between the founder and SoftBank. And so yes, I think this is exactly what happened. Is like valuations went up. Artificial valuations. Again, this is what I've heard. Artificial valuations.
Allegedly.
Artificial growth.
That's the word. Allegedly. Allegedly is the word.
Allegedly. Like, mm-hmm. Because I genuinely don't know. I'm not holding anything back, but I'm like, I have similar information than you have, right? And that the amount of money they were burning through just didn't make sense. Like, it just didn't make sense. And a lot of VCs will say, hey, when we invest, we want you to use the money. Invest it in ads, invest it in... But their acquisition of, like, leasing properties through the roof. A lot of the properties were not at the tenant levels that they said they were. Mm-hmm. But there is, I guess... It also is very much an American way of doing business. It's like hypergrowth, and that the goal is that eventually that hypergrowth will pay off, right? But allegedly, the folks that put information out about WeWork is that money was just being pissed away. And so was it money laundering? I don't know. Was it like I don't know what they were doing with the money, but the amount of money that was being invested just didn't make sense. Like, why would a company need that amount of capital? Mm-hmm. And where is it going to? Was it a Ponzi scheme? Maybe. But I don't know who would have fared well out of that situation outside of the founder, to be honest. Because from what I hear, SoftBank changed the terms of a lot of those agreements in the final hour. A lot of LPs that had invested, a lot of other investors that invested didn't make their money.
What does LP stand for?
Oh, limited partners.
Limited partners, okay.
A lot of the limited partners in these VC funds that had poured money into the funds and the funds into WeWork, I don't think they made the returns that they expected. This is what I hear. So I'm just not sure who benefited from that whole WeWork thing other than the founders of WeWork, because they got clipped. But they got paid out really nice. I don't even know what the figures are. There's been all kinds of figures. The founder apparently went off like
he cashed
out crazy amount of capital. But other than the founder, I don't know. Unless they just walked away from a lot of their obligations to suppliers and whatever, that would have been the only way I think they would have made money. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I think they still owe people money. Maybe they just didn't pay. I don't know. I don't think they claimed bankruptcy. To my knowledge, I don't know if they did. So I just don't know who made money out of that deal. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. But it was, the transaction levels were through the roof. Like, through the roof.
Most definitely.
Crazy money.
Now, I want to really provide our SMB entrepreneur with some value, you know. Like, for instance, when should you start reaching out to VCs to get funding? Mm-hmm. You know, like, one of my clients actually... You know, he has about 2 to 3 revenue streams for his business. He's selling, you know, I don't want to give a bit out his scene, but he's selling direct-to-consumer products, right? Mm-hmm. One to retail, one through D2C, pardon me. And one thing he's facing is logistical issues with shipping to the States. So I'm like, oh, this could be a funding thing where more funding so he can actually afford to drop rates. So you can give that shipping to acquire more customers and then have that LTV because the product is that good, right? But he's saying, I don't know how to evaluate my business. Mm-hmm. What would you say to a guy like that?
If he's, so there's two models, right? Because you're saying there's a direct-to-consumer and then there's a...
Retail.
There's retail, like actual brick-and-mortar retail?
Brick-and-mortar, yeah.
Anything brick-and-mortar's... tricky. Mm-hmm. In terms of valuation, I don't think you can just look at like without more information and build a valuation just like without looking at the numbers.
For sure.
But I mean, if he's a revenue driven business, then revenue is a good indicator to start, right? Cause is there a technology there or is it
product? It's strictly product. You know, he makes I don't want to beat out this scene, but he makes a consumable product.
Okay. So if he hears this or you want to pass it on to him, look at a company called Clearco. Mm-hmm. Are you guys familiar with Clearco?
Very Clearco. Very, very clear on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I think Clearco's model is phenomenal because if you are generating revenue, especially like B2C, then you can just enter your information into their system and it actually provides a valuation of where you're at. And they will provide you with funding, which is non-dilutive funding. So they don't take a piece of your company. They give you a loan at a very low rate. And as you sell, it's like on an earn-out basis, they get their money back, but at a very nice interest rate. So it's not hurting your business, it's helping your business. But what you're sharing with me about the shipping, that's one of the biggest challenges for B2C, is the logistics. It's not the selling of the product, it's the shipping of the product. Do you know what, if he's using Shopify,
Shopify.
He's using Shopify, yeah. And he's still having logistical problems?
Product's $15, shipping's $15.
His challenges of B2C, mm-hmm. is logistics. Mm-hmm. We ran into it with Nishi. People were buying products, but the cost of shipping was through the roof, and that's why Amazon is killing it now, because Amazon's they're not an e-commerce company, they're a shipping company.
Yeah.
And they figured out shipping, but it took them 13 years to figure out shipping.
Mm.
So, I hate to say it, if you can't bring your shipping costs down, he might be in trouble for a very long time, because COVID has just driven shipping prices up. I know some of the biggest companies right now are struggling getting their products to consumers. It's taking them 2 to 4 weeks longer because of shipping, not because the product's inferior or the pricing's not right, but it's right across the board. So he's not the only one. So his competitors are experiencing shipping issues as well. So that's going to be tricky. And I don't think funding's going to help him.
Mm, really?
No, I wasn't saying funding's going to help him with shipping.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking funding will help him bear the cost. So he can leverage that shipping as cost to acquire a customer. Because if they
read that again, it's like having a little more capital just to hold,
to hold them over the shipping cost. Because the product is so good that after $100, you can afford to give him free shipping. And he has a range of products.
Can he do that? Can he set his minimum a little higher to offset it? So
it's $15.
Where he says, okay, for example, minimum, if you spend up to $60 or if you spend up to $80, then shipping is an option.
Because
so many companies do that, and you don't realize why, like the Bay, for example, if you spend $100, shipping's free. That $100 is just not out of thin air. It's because they realize that if they can capture, a $100 sale will give them a $30 margin.
Mm.
And then they can still lose another $15 because at the end of the day, from the 30, they can still walk away with 15.
Mm-hmm.
So there's enough of a margin there for them to offer free shipping. He needs to find out what his margin is. What's the minimum amount he needs to sell,
mm-hmm.
to a customer to be able to continue to offer shipping? And I'd say that has to be his first. He needs to run that number first, because 15 for 15, yeah, you don't have a business. But if he says, hey, if I sell 3 of these, then it's worth it. If it's worth it, and only he can run the numbers, then that's what he needs to put on his site or his whatever. It's like minimum orders of $60,
mm-hmm.
shipping. Then he can bear that. Otherwise, the customer has to bear it. But somebody needs to bear it. More funding is not going to solve that. It's mm-hmm. just going to tie him over. His runway is going to be longer. But he's going to be stuck with the same problem a year from now or 2 years from now. He needs to find out what his margin is. What's the minimum sale amount that he needs to survive and keep thriving?
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a big gem. So as we're wrapping up, anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to quickly mention?
No, I feel bad because you guys really wanted me to cover VC and I didn't get to answer your questions for your viewers. But I'm an open book. You can ask me anything.
Most definitely. Maybe we'll figure out a way to do a part 2. We definitely got caught up in the weeds.
We talked about all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. It was great. Yeah. I think it's... we learned a lot about you, your journey, and it makes sense. We don't have to, VC, talking about VC is cool. We can talk about it, but I think the story mm-hmm. of, being a Parkdale native, going through the whole journey,
Parkdale? Yeah.
And it was great. Now, thank you so much for coming today.
But do say to your friend, VC, almost any VC, they look at TAM. Do you know what TAM is?
No. Total addressable market.
Most VCs, if you can't lay out for them that their total addressable market is at least $1 billion, most VCs are not going to fund you.
Okay.
$1 billion is that magic number typically. There are VCs that will play with less. We will play with less in some cases because of the returns we also have to provide to our investors. Most, it doesn't mean that you have $1 billion in revenue. It just means that whatever market you've identified is going to buy your product, that market can actually produce at some point in the future $1 billion of revenue to your company.
Oh, that's huge.
So,
with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up the podcast. The hustle is what you can control. So control your grind and control your life. I'm Alex.
And I'm Owen.
Giselle.
She caught it.
Love
and
you
that's
guys.
Hustle over everything, y'all.
Hustle over Peace. Everything. No
Have a great week, guys.